Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Welcome to The Game Podcast, the podcast that plays the full 90 minutes, or probably more like 40 minutes. Today I'm joined by Alison Rudd, Patty Barkley, and from a secret, undisclosed location in West London, in the wonderful place we call Barnes, it's Matt Dickinson. Later on we'll be discussing footballers and their entourages, but first, we're going to start with an apology. Yes, last week in the quick hit section, we did mention the fact that Frank Lampard scored a hat trick, and we ridiculed the Game podcast panelist who had said Lampard was rubbish. But our evil producer, Chris Skinner, who happens to be a Spurs fan, cut that part out of the podcast. So Frank Lampard didn't get his due, and thereby fueling reports that there is an anti-Lampard conspiracy going on. Frank, we apologize. I had you in the script. Thank you. Now, that out of the way, let's talk some England. And there's one place to start, I think. It's a 2-2 draw. It's good. England qualify undefeated. Capello still can't speak English. Let's all laugh at him. Yada, yada, yada. We bet off with Harry. We'll get to all that. But first, we have to start with the fact that England's best player will miss certainly the first game, possibly the second game of the actual Euro 2012 competition for that red card, which I think most of us would deem was unnecessary. Patty, I know you got lukewarm feelings about this.
Yeah. I think you said it, that he's likely to be suspended for one match or two. I think that if he's suspended for one match or two, UEFA will be falling down on their duty. I think if we look back to the last European Championship, Andriy Arshavin was banned for the first two matches, and this has been used as a sort of yardstick. I took the precaution over the weekend of watching over and over again on YouTube the incident for which Arshavin was banned. It was a red card, straight red card against Andorra, also in the final match of qualification. What happened was that Arshavin was fouled quite nastily by an Andorra defender as he tried to complete a 1-2. He got a bit sick of being grabbed around the face and neck and took a little sly kick at the guy who collapsed like a sack of spuds. That's completely, it was a very minor offence. I mean, obviously it wasn't good, you shouldn't retaliate, and if Rooney had done that, we'd still have a go at him. But Rooney's offence was far, far worse. He was not fouled. He reacted simply to the fact that a player was using his body to shield the ball while it was within playing distance, which is perfectly legitimate footballing tactic at which Rooney is very good himself. Because of this, Rooney got frustrated, lashed out, in a really violent way at the guy's ankles. So I would say that that it should be a minimum of three matches if UEFA are to be consistent.
I would have thought the Arshavin precedent was based on the fact that any suspensions for infractions committed against a country like Andorra are automatically doubled to punish stupidity. But I think you do have a valid argument there if you go on precedent. Dicko, are you prepared to throw the book at Rooney?
Well, I mean, put it this way: if it was in if it was in a domestic game, it would be three matches, you know, without any question for violent conduct. I mean, UEFA have got. I mean, I think the tariffs of what we've seen before suggest two, but equally, I think I'm pretty sure Ribery got three matches from UEFA. I remember for a sort of over the top tackle that was, you know, not a different type of offence from Rooney's, but you know they have thrown three match games at people in club football. I just think in international football, generally, the precedents we've looked at point to two. But I agree with Paddy in the sense of if he got three games, you couldn't be up in arms about it. I mean, there's a bloke stood there and he booted him in the calves with the ball about 10 feet away. So, I mean, we could have no violins out.
Alison, I'm assuming you were never sent off in your playing career?
I don't think so. No. I don't know, maybe this isn't relevant at all, but what I thought was particularly interesting was that Rooney had a little girly tap at the ankles of the player first. And I got the impression he thought, oh my goodness, people are going to think I'm a big girl's blouse. I have an image. I can't just look like I'm a bit annoyed and I've been outwitted. I've got to go for it. It was one of the most peculiar red card offences I think I've seen. But I don't think I'd bring retaliation, a retaliatory offence like Carl Chavin's into it, because I think FIFA and football authorities generally, they're really scared of retaliatory actions by footballers. And in a way,
that makes it worse.
They just they're very scared of players acting because they're angry. It's like, let us police the games. Please do not try and take out your own retribution.
The perfect example was in the way the punishment. This was not UEFA, but this was the Spanish Football Federation, who in the case of Mourinho against Villanova, they actually gave Villanova a one match ban and Mourinho a two-match ban, where Mourinho stuck his finger in the guy's eye and the guy sort of reacts by sort of shoving him on the shoulder in retaliation.
But now, the best part about that, Paddy, of course, is you know that ban only applies in the Spanish Super Cup.
Exactly.
Well, it's funny, I mean, we flew back on the same plane as Wolfgang Stark and his team, and he spoke to some of the chaps at the airport and said, I think they were quite surprised. He was sort of went out of his way to say, look, you know, respect to Rooney for the way he, you know, he handled Michonne in the red card and the way he walked off the pitch. So the good thing is that you know, we may have a very loose cannon, but at least he's a polite loose cannon. That's good news.
I think it's also just very briefly, Arshavin walked off the pitch without protest as well. So there is just no argument for anything less than three in this case.
The broader issue now, I think, for England is, what do you do between now and when the Euros come around? Because there's two schools of thought. I mean, Rooney is an integral part of the England team, has been, should be, I think you'd be the lunatic not to argue that.
Correct.
But do you start trying other solutions, other players in the friendlies, and just not call him since there's no real point, since he won't be playing until game two or three, especially if he gets a longer ban?
I have no idea why Capello felt the need to tell people that he's thinking of not involving Rooney in any of the friendlies. It's this idea that you have to say something big and meaningful after a major incident.
Sorry, is the idea maybe that has happened on Sky after the match and I wasn't there, he gets asked the same question violently and aggressively 30 different ways, and because his English is what it is, ultimately, you know, if he says, I don't know, he's being indecisive. If he says, no, Rooney, then he's being horrible.
It wasn't beaten out of him, that's for sure. I mean, I agree with Alison's point. I think he went further than he needed to. I mean, it was the fourth interview he'd done that evening, I mean, sometimes he says things that surprise his assistants and others, and aren't always consistent. So I agree with Alison. He's gone further than he needs to. That said, and there is a logic. There would be more logic to Rooney playing maybe in the next couple of games and then being left out of the couple of friendlies for the championships. But that said, without contradicting myself, hopefully I wouldn't play him against Spain, because I think in some ways you need to A, tell him you screwed up and this is life without you now. B, you need to start empowering other players to think, right, we are not dependent on Rooney. And C, the last time he played against Spain was in the Bernabeu Stadium.
He was sent off by his own manager.
He was hauled off, exactly, in a fit, threw in a black armband on the floor because he'd lost the plot. And generally the pattern when we play against Spain is that they get the ball and then the game finishes 90 minutes later. And, the last thing we need is Rooney stood on the halfway line seething again as Spain take the mickey out of us at Wembley.
I completely agree with that. I think that if Capello is sensible, he will continue to play Rooney, but only in training. I think that
can I jump in there? Because that's an interesting scenario you brought up. In fact, that's what I would do. I would because if you just don't play him at all, then the only people are happy about it is Sir Alex Ferguson. So you still make him come to England training, but you just don't play him.
The only people who would gain from playing him in the actual matches would be the England's prospective opponent. I mean, there's absolutely nothing to be gained from that. Also, what the mistake we always make, it happens every 2 years, we imagine that there's a huge, long, yawning gap of time before qualification in which experiments may be made at leisure. There is no leisure now. The clock is ticking very, very fast. And those matches come thick. It sounds great. Five friendlies before. The problem is, with England players' injury record, your plans are always disrupted. They must use all of these matches to work on plan B. And that can't be stressed enough. Time is shorter than we think.
Well, looking at plan B, looking at some of these other players, Darren Bent started and scored. I think, he's not the perfect striker, and he's got back to goal issues and so on. He likes to be up front in his zone. But Tico, given that England don't play 4-4-2 anyway, and they've always got somebody behind, could Darren Bent be the answer? Do we sometimes overlook him a little bit because he plays for Villa,
If the question was going to be Bent, my answer was going to be no. I don't want to be too disparaging of a guy who's scored plenty of goals in the Premiership, and he's no dunce. But I have to say, I just have this vision of a crucial game, a crucial chance, Darren Bent standing there, and the whole world freezing as he prepares to shank it or sky it. He's done that at Wembley. I think was it the Switzerland game at home. But I just don't trust him in a critical moment in a critical game, I'm afraid.
I'm sure George Culkin disagrees with you, but
I feel the wrath of Culkin descending on my bald head.
On this show, though, if you dish somebody, you got to give an alternative. So who's your choice?
My longing would be that Welbeck plays enough games. I mean, he's played all of about 23 minutes, I think, of international football. So, I am fully prepared to accept that I am punting here, but I just hope Welbeck plays enough for Man United. I mean, Welbeck's already surprised me. He looks a better player this season already than I thought he was capable of. And I just pray that he can sustain and that he gets enough games at Man United to sustain, because I think potentially he's an infinitely better player than
Dan Bent. People will talk about Sturridge, but Welbeck's a class above Sturridge. The other thing about Welbeck is that he's developing. He's younger than Sturridge, I think, but he's developing much faster. He's obviously more intelligent footballer, football-wise, than Sturridge. And I think Welbeck's a real, real prospect.
By the way, I respectfully count myself out of those people who believe that you have to play a five-man midfield. Yeah. I completely disagree.
I think the most important thing is to play two lines of midfield. I don't think it really matters whether it's five or four, but I mean, 4-2-1, I beg your pardon, I wonder if in this interregnum, before Rooney becomes available again, that England might be better switching from 4-2-3-1 to 4-3-1-2, because the reason I say that is that I think that Wilshere could be a genuine number 10.
Where would Ashley Young go?
Ashley Young
would go to the bench in your world?
No, he would be one of the two. And
Ashley Young
at the front, yeah. I think he could play there. And I think that, I mean, I'm glad you brought up Ashley Young, because amid all the doom and gloom, what we perhaps understandably overlooked was that Ashley Young had put in yet another genuine international performance. It's becoming consistent.
And he showed a lot of personality.
He showed personality. Match in, match out, he's looking a real international player and a threat to everybody with that pace. He'll win free kicks. Unfortunately, we don't have Beckham now to whack him in, but we don't even have Rooney. he's going to win free kick after free kick if England want them. I just think that's such a plus. And has to be balanced against the loss of Rooney. I think this is a good time to lose Rooney, to be quite honest. The qualifying matches, let's be honest, if England hadn't got out of the qualifying group, everyone would be, you know, calling posthumously for Capello's head anyway. We expect England to get out of the group. We expect them to be beaten soon afterwards. But let's be honest, that group's not going to be difficult. Even if Rooney gets a three-match ban, it'll be from...
No way. You look at the pots. We could have a group that is England, Spain, Portugal and France.
You could just as easily have, you know, Ukraine.
You could have Poland, like... Greece. But all I'm saying is that there will be stronger groups in the Euros than there ever will be in the World Cup.
But bizarrely, though, it's funny because with the way the pots work out, England are better off being a two seed than being a one seed, I think, because the teams in the two seed, there is more strength and depth. I mean, the only one seed that really scares me, frankly,
is a myth, isn't there, that England would be better off in a group with smaller nations in it. England do particularly badly against those nations that lift their game and have marvellous
spirit.
Whereas
you do very well
spirit.
Against Spain.
In
yes?
European Championships, okay. England do particularly badly against everybody.
One more thing on the players. I thought Gary Cahill had a poor game. I thought he had a very poor game. And it's interesting to see some of the ratings afterwards because they seem slightly divergent on Cahill. I know Rio Ferdinand is in and out. He's got his issues right now. But Dicko, is the sense that, you know, the role of John Terry partner is still very much open at the heart of the England defence? And did Cahill really help himself?
I agree with you. I didn't think Cahill had a particularly clever game. But then, say, second half, I'm not sure who did. But I think that position is up for grabs. I think Rio, I think they're pretty much prepared to... write off Rio and be pleasantly surprised if he's even in consideration next summer. I mean, taking the captaincy off him sort of underscored that some months ago. I think Capello, Sykes, you know, we know that he judges his players very as much on psychology when it comes to England now, because he has been sort of alarmed at what he regards as fragility of their little minds, and that's why he was full of praise for Jones, who I actually thought was, you know, I mean, Walcott didn't give him as much help as he should have done, but was sort of isolated and slipping on his backside and struggling out wide against tricky wingers. But, you know, Capello was impressed that he kept at it. You know, he worked hard to play a better game. And he likes what he sees of Jones, not just a footballer, but Jones the character. And so I think, you know, he's very hopeful that Jones will play a lot of games at centre-half and can become Terry's partner. You know, we've got a few options. I actually think Jagielka's a good footballer, sort of half-decent centre-half and not top-quality international standard. Cahill can be OK, but they hope that Jones will come through. And you know, I think Jones proves the other day that, you know, as a right back, he will be a top quality centre half.
Also, you know, there's Chris Smalling. So I mean, the cupboard's not going to be bare. You know, there's plenty of promise. I mean, this is the thing. Now we can discuss England. We had an argument about strikers. We were talking about we named three hold the ball up strikers. We named three predatory strikers earlier. We had a really good argument, and that's terrific.
Yeah,
the
difference is all these centre halves who we're mentioning are good. I would argue all these strikers who we're mentioning, with a possible exception of Carroll, who may come good. I don't know that any of these people are that we mentioned are. are that good.
But they're
at
all
that
interesting.
Level.
They're all interesting.
They're all interesting.
Like,
yeah, it's fun to talk about
Phil
crowds
Jones,
of the foe.
You know, Phil Jones, who a year ago was a squad player at Blackburn, is now, being talked about as Terry's successor, and that's sensible. That's good because it reflects the improvement and the exceptional talent of the lad. But. That's what's so good about it. They've got four choices at right back. Okay, only two could be sensible, but there's more choice. I cannot remember a time when there was more reason for promise or excitement about the English national setup.
And we should
setup.
All be thanking Mr. Capello for that, because it's exclusively down to him and nobody else. I want to that was in jest, by the way. I wanted to just close with something. I mean, we all write about football. We all like either sports. I played rugby for a long time. But one thing that gets to me is the rugby snobs dumping all over football. Mm-hmm. And you get it about the footballers are bores. They pay too much money. If they, you know, if they smoke a joint, they should be banned for life, forever. You get that guy who, that Samoan guy who questioned whether the referee and the tournament was somehow prejudiced. You know, he could be getting a lifetime ban. I mean, to me, it's demented the way this sport is run, and the fact that you can get, you know, you can be prevented from doing your profession because somebody doesn't like something you said on Twitter. I find all of this stuff completely absurd. But I also want to knock these people down a few pegs about the sanctimony, and I'm just going to go through a little bit about what happened to England at the World Cup off the pitch. Yes, from the boozing in the bar in very, very public conditions with CCTV, which I don't remember the England team doing. I do remember Teddy Sheringham in the dentist yes. chair, but that was a few years ago, and I believe that was before camp. Of course, most recently, Manu Tulagi jumping off a ferry and being arrested. Two, of course, this business with Johnny Wilkinson's balls, and no, I'm not referring to the stuff in his sack. I'm talking about the business with match his coach and changing the match balls, which is cheating, basically. That's what it is. And because England comes clean and suspends the coaches, but not Wilkinson, who's the guy who actually does the kicking, he just suspends the people who sit on the bench and do nothing, then that's okay. Then you don't need to take further action against them. I just question the sanctimony of these people come down and have a go at football. Football has lots of problems, but you know, I don't think we're talking about people who are whiter than white here criticizing football.
Well, they don't have.
Here's a cool fact: a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact: you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
In football, they don't have cheating over the ball. They don't instruct people, as they do in rugby, to cut their own, have their mouths cut with a scalpel, for goodness sake. Do you remember that?
Yes.
I mean, it's the most filthy game imaginable. The only thing that I would say in defence of rugby is, and I do wish that football could get the respect for referees and the referees who are explicit as rugby referees are. I really do wish we would learn from that. I don't think we have anything else to learn from them.
I know the team games played with the ball, they are culturally so different. That rugby is so disciplined, and there is that respect on the pitch, because what happens off it is actually mind-boggling. You have to prove that you're a part of the team at whatever level in rugby, the things you have to do to prove you're a real bloke. If any one of those things came out in football, they would be front page, middle page, back page story.
Can I give you a really lovely example of that from a very good book written by Matt Hampson and Paul Kimmage, in which they talk about playing for Leicester, and there was a Nigerian back.
Oh, you're not going to read? I was going to read that out, and I thought I couldn't. It's so disgusting.
He's a particularly well-built player in every department, but they used to get a pint. If someone had to have to lie underneath him, someone would pour a pint of beer down his back, which would run down the small of his back through the crack of his bottom, off the end of his, whatever I'm allowed to use on the podcast, word for appendage, and into the mouth of one of his teammates. And Matt Hampson writes about this, saying sort of great times, you know, happy memories.
You are not allowed not to do that. You're not a member of the team unless you can do that.
I mean, I didn't play for Leicester, but
did you indulge in the back second crack drinking game?
Well, actually, the front part was not involved, but I was in a slightly more heterosexual country than this one when I was playing. We did something that was called an anal boot, which it did involve the beer coming down the back over the crack and into a rugby boot, and then you were then to drink said beer out of the boot. That's pretty standard, I think.
Yeah, well, I was brought up in Scotland, where drinking was not a matter for frivolity.
Exactly. Just sawdust on the floor in the pub, right?
Exactly. We didn't want to spill a drop.
Okay, apologies for this rugby detour, but
getting into it.
I know you wanted to read more extracts from Kimmage's book, but we do have to move on. But again, apologies for it. It is International Week, so there is no football. So we have to get a little bit creative. And of course, if you do like to listen to people talking about rugby, the Times do have their own World Cup podcast. The excellent, albeit Spurs fan and Frank Lampard hating Chris Skinner produces that as well. And I appreciate those of you who are of an English bent may not want to hear any more about the World Cup after England's humiliation against France, but it is quite a good podcast. All right, in our debate this week, we're going to look at the issue of footballers, their family members, their entourages. I mean, no hiding the fact, this was prompted by the news on late last week that Wayne Rooney's dad, Wayne Sr., and Rooney's uncle, who... I'm sorry, but he sounds like a Sopranos character, doesn't he? Uncle Richie?
Yeah.
I'm sure when he talks, he's got a completely different accent than the one I just put on. But they were arrested. They're accused of being involved in a case of what we would call spot fixing. But rather than the specifics of this case, I mean, they were released, I think, without charge at this stage. And this is pending an investigation. What I find remarkable is that I would imagine, I don't have any family members who are, you know, who are worth tens of millions of pounds. But if I did, I probably would, to some degree, mooch off them and make sure that I was taken care of and wouldn't have any material wants in the world.
You're not joking, are you?
No. Please, Dallison, elucidate.
I find that an absolutely awful quality, that just because someone you're related to has earned money, that you feel you should have some. I don't even want to take a loan off my dad. I mean, it's you are who you are, and you earn your own way in life. And the worst thing you can be is somebody who has no, who isn't earning their own crust, that they feel because someone they're related to has money, that's in some way reflects upon you and you should benefit from it. That's not how society grows and people become real people.
Mm. No, that is a good point. Let me rephrase that. I would imagine, though, that, I mean, and again, I come from a different culture where I'm not Anglo-Saxon. if somebody's a family member, you take care of them to a certain level of degree. We have this sense that just because you may have a lot more money because you're more successful, if somebody's your blood relative, you make sure that they're not wanting for anything, be it flip-flops or pet food, as to cite another well-known example. I looked at it more in that sense. And so I just find it remarkable that somebody would go and engage in something like this, allegedly. Or there are other cases. There's cases of footballers whose fathers have been have gotten into trouble for dealing coke. Obviously, there was a shoplifting incident involving the mother of, I want to say, another England player, but of course it's the same one. It's difficult. How does this happen?
Well, I think this is really interesting, because I'm not surprised. I'm surprised it doesn't happen more. I think you're more likely to behave badly if the kilter is wrong. If one member of a clan or family is exceptionally wealthy or exceptionally famous, it sort of makes everyone else feel like they're nobody, and they have to show that they have character and they are still themselves and they're still big enough to rise above whatever notoriety this member of the family has. I think it's rather odd to assume that everybody remotely related to one person who's very famous or very rich or represents their country is suddenly going to behave differently, and their lives, they're going to queue differently in a queue, they're going to get on a bus differently, they're going to buy a ticket in a more polite way just to prove that they're not going to let down this member of the family. They're desperate to say, I am me, and I will do what I want to do, and I'll be as irresponsible or law-breaking as I like. Thank you.
Yes. If I had a son who was an incredibly rich footballer, I'd want to demonstrate my independence by going out and doing a bit of shoplifting too. But the... to be serious, there are two stories on this, and these are both absolutely true stories. One of them is, I think, quite funny. The other one is very unfunny. The first one is about, I used to know the father of an extremely famous international footballer, and once I met him just before Christmas, and I said, oh, what's name of extremely famous international footballer getting you for Christmas? And he said, I always get the same thing, a season ticket, which the player whose fortune would be estimated would be way, way above £10 million, probably a long way above £10 million, got for free. And that is all he ever got. And you could argue that maybe the player who could have afforded to have bought him a house, a car, a different one every year, was respecting his dad's independence. The second one is the story of Mark Vivian Foe, who we will all remember played in France and in England for Manchester City, certainly, and he was with Manchester City when he died, a very good player, when he died tragically playing in the Confederations Cup,
yeah,
in France in 2000, and where was it? I can't remember. But anyway, we all remember that incident. But there was the tragedy was compounded because Mark Vivian Foe had been a sort of cash point for a wide family, a wide group of family and friends. He had a big house in France. He had a huge house in, you know, the older Liège area where footballers who play for Manchester clubs live. He'd been earning, I guess, I mean, money wasn't what it was, but he'd been earning $2 to $3 million a year for a sustained period. And he died not only penniless, but leaving massive bills for rent. Because, I mean, all these houses had been packed with family and friends who'd been living off him, many of them receiving salaries. And his widow and children, FIFA tried to arrange matches, but they were destitute. So the widow of someone who'd been earning all that money for all that time, I don't know I confess, I don't know what's happened to her now. But
on that point, his son actually spoke at the World Cup in South Africa.
Mm. Have FIFA sorted them out?
And
I mean, no one else lifted a finger to help them.
I mean, FIFA have tried to put together a stipend. I believe, I could be mistaken, I believe West Ham also have contributed
for whom
something.
He also played, yeah.
It is India. I think in certain cultures, especially footballers who come from certain backgrounds,
yes,
it's not,
Africans,
you know, I mean,
above all.
Samuel Eto'o has an enormous entourage of people. Some of them his relatives, some of them people who act as if they were his relatives, who live with him. And I presume all these people have now moved to Moscow now, or maybe they're still hanging out at his big house in Milan. I'm not sure.
Which is worse? It's interesting. I mean, I've had it on the first story. I mean, I know of a prominent England international who gets a lot of free cars through a deal and sold one of those free cars to his father-in-law. and I remember him telling me the story and sort of couldn't quite understand why my jaw was bouncing off the floor as he said, "Well, I sold it at cost price. You know, what's the problem?"
Now
I don't know whether to admire his financial prudence, or actually, I think that was actually swamped by just amazement that a guy with millions in the bank would think that the father-in-law should be forced to pay his way, basically.
But Dicko, I want to ask you about this because I mean, I've met. I think it's an open secret that you're quite familiar with the Neville clan, and I've met the dad, Neville on several occasions, and he seems like a completely normal, well-adjusted person. Mm. I cannot imagine him doing any of these things. I know part of it is he was involved in football, and he had his own. I believe he was the secretary at Bury in the day, and he's, you know, he has his own interests and so on. But what's your take on this dynamic? Because he still has, you know, three kids who are a lot more successful than he is. Two of them a lot wealthier than he is. You know, if. I mean,
well, in that instance, they've got a, you know, and it speaks well of the parents and the kids and the environment they brought up in that it's a very healthy dynamic. I mean, he was a lorry driver who worked sort of shaped his lorry driving days around helping his kids to play more sport through that sort of dynamic. They became the great sportsmen they are, and now, you know, he's had independent jobs, but he's also done a lot of work for that. You know, when their sponsorship deal is sorted out, their Man U contracts have been sorted out. There's been three people in the room: as David Gill, Gary Neville, and his dad. No agent taking a fortune, and they haven't deemed it necessary. Just get a lawyer to look over the contracts and make sure everything's tickety-boo. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm sure he's had some nice holidays out of it. He's had some, you know, got to stay in some nice places, and, you know, they've looked after him, and in fact he lives in a house that was bought years back by Gary. Yeah. So it's been a very good sort of beneficial relationship. But equally, you know, say when there's a contract to be signed, they don't give it to they don't get fleeced by someone. They sort it out as a family. But I would say that they're an uncommonly sensible and uncommonly loyal and uncommonly sort of trustworthy and tight bunch.
Yeah, I mean, we'd all agree that Nevilles are an exemplary sporting family. But there's the other course, of course, which is the middle course, you might say, which is taken by Sir Alex Ferguson on behalf of his family. He is able to help his family out without at absolutely no cost to himself. For example, by employing them at Manchester United. There was his son, Jason, who had an agency, and unfortunately, due to a BBC documentary, Manchester United had to stop using Jason. So that worked, but only temporarily. Jason Ferguson then became his dad's agent. So there was a way of helping out your family without any cost to yourself. Before that, of course, Darren Ferguson was employed by Manchester United and and made his start in the career very creditably.
Employment match, he was a professional footballer.
He was a professional
who
footballer
was good enough to play for Manchester United.
Indeed, and to win a championship medal with them before finding his level, a slightly lower level, and is now making his way in management. So he's had a jolly good career, mainly by his own efforts, but with a little help from his father, I'm sure, quite rightly so.
He also has a third son.
Mark Ferguson has never needed any help, extremely talented young man.
Tell us what he does.
Alex Ferguson, he works in the city, and has been very successful in his own right. Martin Ferguson is Alex's brother. He was made his way as a player, footballer in Scotland, and as a coach. Unfortunately, got sacked about 15 years ago. And since then, he's worked from his home on the outskirts of Glasgow as Manchester United's globe-trotting scout. And as far as I know, he still has that job. So again, there's a way of Sir Alex managed to help out a member of his family without any cost to himself. So there's a template that if any of us were as powerful as Sir Alex Ferguson, we could all follow.
Okay, how about some quick hits now? Paddy, Scotland hold their fate in their hands when it comes to qualifying for Euro 2012. All they need to do to make the playoffs is to better or equal the result of the Czech Republic, who, of course, are away to Lithuania. Scotland, alas, have to travel to Spain.
I knew there'd be a snag.
And at the weekend, of course, they did only beat Liechtenstein 1-0. What's more likely? That your boys will make it to Poland or Ukraine, or that you will grow an afro?
Well, I'm very encouraged by that choice. I certainly think we've got more chance of getting to Poland, Ukraine. You never know. The point is, if at various stages of this tournament you'd said that we would still be in with a chance going into the final game, at least a chance of earning two more games, I would have bitten your hand off. And I just think it's terrific. And besides, as a Scotland supporter myself, if we get beaten by Spain, that's great. It's like being beaten by Brazil in 1982. You don't mind being beaten by artists. And, this is going to be one of those lovely games which you're able to sit back and watch with a cigar, six-pack, and just wish both sides well. But I think Scotland are out.
Alison, Fulham are reportedly considering expanding Craven Cottage to a capacity of 30,000. Now, given that you live closer to the ground than any of us, I have to ask, is this really a good idea? And will they ever get planning permission?
Well, it's not reportedly, it's true. They do want to expand it. It's a modest increase in seating. And in that sense, it's a good idea. What's the point of Fulham looking for a new stadium that can house 60,000? They're not going to fill it. And they are doing it sensibly. They're going to give back to the locals, who will obviously instinctively oppose it, but they're going to give them the facilities, and there's going to be a new path along the Thames. And I think it all sounds rather lovely.
Yes, very bucolic in that part of West London. Bruce Buck says that Chelsea still plan on breaking even at some point, but meanwhile, fans are reportedly planning a protest against high ticket prices at the next Champions League home game. Dicko, how do Chelsea get out of this bind? Can they realistically break even without sliding back several rungs in the pecking order? And if you're particularly interested in this subject, I invite you all, in addition, to listen to the answer that Dicko's about to give, to read Matthew Syed in the game today.
Well, obviously, what they need to do is get Peter Kenyon back. He is the genius that they lack to make them rich. I'm joking. Just one point not sort of answered by Matthew in his piece this morning is, do they fill 60,000 seats? I think they would do half a dozen times a season. Maybe they would get more fans in. But it's interesting. Alison mentioned Fulham getting a bigger stadium, QPR looking at a bigger stadium, Chelsea 60,000. I live in West London. My mates aren't walking around saying, I want to spend 100 quid for me and a mate to go and watch football. Who's going to fill these seats?
Wealthy people from the Gulf, I guess.
Yeah.
It is a very pertinent question.
As a pal of mine texted the other day, how can you bulldoze 7 years of history?
Chelsea was founded in 1905. When you see your friend next time, smack him in the face for me, okay?
Now, one for you. We all know about qualifying for the European Championships, but the African Cup of Nations qualifiers wrapped up this weekend as well. How did the big boys do?
Very, very badly, in fact, Patty. And I'm glad you asked. With the exception of Ivory Coast, who topped their group, and Ghana, who qualified on the last day. Of the six African nations who went to the 2010 World Cup, four of them actually failed to qualify for the African Cup of Nations. And in fact, Egypt, of course, also failed to qualify for the African Cup of Nations, which is a bit of a shock given that they had won the last three. It's going to be pretty much a completely new set of characters come January.
And in this new world order, or this new African continental order, are there any emergent nations that we're going to hear a lot more about in on the world stage in the next 10 years?
Well, Senegal aren't exactly an emerging nation, but I think they probably are the best placed African team to take on Ivory Coast and Ghana. Of the others, I would look out for Burkina Faso, who there's some dispute over feeling an eligible player, but they certainly look very strong. But there's countries like Libya and Sudan, two countries who I think are wonderful stories given the civil war that those nations have been through. That's all we've got time for today, but remember, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, the web chats. Patty's is on Mondays, mine is on Tuesdays. You can also follow us on Twitter, and of course, our live show is coming soon. More information on the website. That's all we've got time for this week. Till next week, bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.